I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives.
Correct. Craft. Oh, we started now. Yes.
Yes, of course we've started.
I'd been working at the Playbox Theatre, and I'd worked as an ASM on a show, a Louis Nara show, The Golden Age.
The golden years of Hollywood. That was what I loved.
Absolutely don't profess to be good at it at all. I could study and I could be much more diligent in my homework.
So in a sense, you know, I think really good directors are really good editors.
I was really incapable of going on, not just as a writer, but I felt as if I was incapable of going on as a human.
One more day before the storm. And Trevor says, stop. He said, you look like little Lord Fauntleroy, dip the wig.
They swooped in and just... Every scene I had with all those different people, they just made it work.
But after some time, I realised that grey comes in many, many hues.
I've had the luck, and without the luck, I know plenty of entertainers out there that are wonderful, funny, just never had the breaks.
I'm what I would call a dancer's dancer. Like, all I ever wanted to do was dance.
You've got a better memory than me, that's for sure.
Oh, I've done my research. I've cheated.
And you'd had a little piece of paper there, mind you, so have I.
Yeah, we both had pieces of paper, so that's been
alright. I wasn't silly, was I?
No, I think it was great. Yeah. Thank you, Sheila.
Thank you, Peter. God bless.
Hello, dear listener. I'm Peter Ayers, and welcome to this episode of Stages. End of March, approaching April. It's time on the Sydney calendar for the return to Opera Australia's Handa Opera on Sydney Harbour. This year, the company restages their acclaimed production of Leonard Bernstein's West Side Story, an eternal favourite with both fans of the musical theatre and opera, as with its lush score has made it a staple of opera companies around the world. I'm delighted that my guest today is the renowned opera and theatre director Francesca Zambello, who helms this magnificent production of West Side Story on the Sydney Harbour Floating Stage. Francesca Zambello directed the 2012 Handa Opera on Sydney Harbour production of La Traviata, as well as The Love for Three Oranges for Opera Australia in 2016. Her production of West Side Story on Sydney Harbour premiered in 2019, for which Francesca received the Helpman Award for Best Direction of a Musical. Francesca joined Stages during a break in rehearsals and elaborated on her approach to staging this masterpiece and reflected on her own celebrated career in the worlds of opera and musical theatre. So, Francesca, welcome to Australia. You obviously enjoy travel. It takes you all around the world. There are perks to it. You get to visit new countries and indulge in their cultures. But I'm sure there are challenges also, being away from home.
Well, I mean, obviously travel is one of the great things about this job. You get to experience so many different cultures. I've been around the world many times. I have been honored to come to this country a number of times. I love Australia. And I often think that Australians are very close to Americans in a lot of our shared sensibilities. I will say for about the past 15 years or so, I've tried to stay much more closer to home with kids growing up and getting through high school and into colleges and things like that. So I haven't traveled the world as much. The first half of my career, I definitely was a globetrotter and worked a great deal in Europe and Asia and Japan and here and all over America, but lately I've been more closer to home. But I really wanted to come to Australia this time because I'm very fond of this production, West Side Story, doing it outside on the harbor. I love the experience on the harbor, and I'm thrilled that my colleague Joe Davies is the new artistic director of the company here, so I wanted to come and be supportive. So it sort of was a synthesis of all these things that convinced me to come back.
Of course, we saw your production of West Side Story premiere in 2019, so it's absolutely wonderful to see it return to Handa Opera on Sydney Harbour. Francesca, you're a storyteller. What makes a good story?
Well, I think every good story starts if you have good characters, because good characters, something is going to happen. Conflict, drama, passion, love. You know, Rodgers and Hammerstein said you can't have anything good without a love story. The Greeks knew that too. And so I think that those are the elements, of course, that help me as a director tell a good story, but you need characters who have meat on their bones to start with. And of course, in this instance, we're very fortunate that things started with Shakespeare and then went to Stephen Sondheim and Leonard Bernstein, and of course, great choreography and great book as well.
The rest is history, so they say. Yes, one of the great love stories in the world, culturally, from Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet right through to the masterpiece, which is West Side Story. The lyrics were penned by, of course, the great Stephen Sondheim, and within it there is a song called Somewhere. I'll just quote some of the lyrics. There's a time for us, some day a time for us. Time together with time to spare, time to learn and time to care. Someday, somewhere, we'll find a way of living. We'll find a way of forgiving. Somewhere, somewhere. With what's happening in the world at the moment, it would seem that West Side Story, though it was written in 1957, is as relevant as ever.
There's no question that this piece keeps giving and keeps sharing with us and keeps making us think about it. It's obviously, we're in an incredibly divisive time in the world, and coming from the United States, we're in a time where we have very little gray. Everything is one side of the fence or the other. And clearly, we're very politically divided as a nation right now. We're about to have a rematch of the same two candidates that we had before. And we are in the midst of deciding whether we should be supporting the Ukraine, what kind of help we can give to the Middle East. And so those issues are so hot for people. And the way that people can't accept other cultures and other people is very much a red flag in the United States right now. And I think it's a global issue, of course. I don't feel that level of divisiveness in Australia. Perhaps I'm being naive, but I do think that it is so strong right now. And this piece just lays it right out there. And it's wonderful rehearsing this piece because everyone in the cast, except for what we call the adult characters, who one runs, you know, a soda shop, Doc, a cop named Krupke, and Schrank, who's the detective. I mean, those are the only really the important adults in the piece, and everyone else is a member of the Shark Gang or the Jets Gang. And they're all like, you know, 16 to 22 years old, and they are in real life as well. So sometimes just talking to them and making and hearing their thoughts about the world is, you know, is incredibly illuminating to me. But I also feel that they, like the characters in this piece, they want to belong to something. They want to belong, they want their own tribe, their own gang.
Those adult characters certainly present a window for us as adult audience to look through. You've got Doc who just wants the kid, they want the kids to wake up and look at themselves and what's going to become of the world if they don't mend their ways. And there's someone like Schrank who just wants to write them off.
Right. Right, and he, of course, represents exactly the kind of character who we see in real life now all over, someone who is very racist, discriminates against them. He does, of course, side much more with the Jets because he, like most of the Jets, I'm sure, is now a second-generation American, not a first-generation American, in this case, the Puerto Ricans. And you know, one of the most telling lines in the piece is when in the song America, where Anita says, you know, don't forget, Puerto Rico is part of America. It is part of the United States. And, you know, people still treat so much people from you know, other cultures, or certainly from Puerto Rico, or now people flooding over the border from the South. We're just encountering incredible discrimination in our country and real outright hatred and racism. Just, you see it everywhere.
It seems to be worse than ever since COVID, in a way. It seems to be growing.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, we did go through 4 years of a president who allowed us to very outspoken and I think very rude and made it okay to say and misbehave.
A valid point. The fish rots from the head, doesn't
right,
it?
Right, yes.
Yeah.
And so I think that has definitely changed our culture, and I'm certainly am one of the many people who are very embarrassed by that. I mean, I'm embarrassed by the position of America in the global picture right now. I mean, we should be, I know we're here to talk about West Side Story, but we should be much, you know, helping much more in terms of humanitarian aid around the world right now, and it's being blocked by our government. Mm.
And I see today that both Trump and Biden have won the candidates.
Yes, so it's
a rematch.
We're having a rematch. Mm. And so what will happen in the ensuing months until November is I think, going to be a real roller coaster. We don't know what's going to happen. It's not so clear.
You've directed West Side Story about seven times, I think, around the world. Does it have different resonances in different countries? I mean, I'm thinking, of course, the great tragedy at the end of the piece is delivered with a gun. We don't have guns in Australia. Of course, anybody can buy a gun in the States.
Right. I mean, that was in this year, before here, I actually did direct it in Chicago. And Chicago is a city that is facing incredible issues with the police force right now. And we worked with a number of different programs about gun control and youth. We had a lot of programs about it. And I think that when they wrote the piece, they could never have imagined that gun control would be such a hot issue in the United States. And of course, it's in talking to people here, I know it's not an issue the way it is for us, but it is an awful part of America, as we have witnessed these incredible tragic shootings in schools and everywhere. Where, you know, people are not just armed with guns, but, you know, with incredibly powerful guns and, you know, killing completely innocent citizens and children. It's this huge tragedy. I mean, more children have been killed this year so far by guns than the number of days in the year so far.
Wow. It's heartbreaking. And some 70 years since the piece was written.
Right. And I don't think that they realized that the gun issue would be so strong, and they certainly could never have imagined that the racism that they watched in New York City at that time would have escalated to this level.
I know that through your work at the Glimglass Festival, you took musicals, operas into prisons, Attica Prison. Yeah. And I think West Side Story was one of them.
Yes, it was.
What was the reaction with the prisoners to the piece?
Well, it's interesting. So Attica is a very storied prison in America. It's a maximum security prison. And it's in central New York, which is where the Glimmerglass Festival is, which was a summer music festival. And we started by bringing operas there every year. We did it for 7 years until COVID. And initially, it was, you know, the guards and everyone working there was very apprehensive, and the inmates really were sort of standoffish. And after we'd done it for a few years, it became a very celebrated event there, I know. And then we started working with a lot of the inmates. We started bringing music classes, and then we developed a chorus of inmates who performed with the soloists who we brought there. So West Side Story, we actually had a chorus of inmates who were Jets and Sharks who performed with our leads. So we brought all the leads. We did not do the whole piece. We did about an hour of it. But so we went from being held at a distance to really being embraced in that community. And it's so interesting that you mentioned that, because the theater group there was a theater group, but we sort of built on that. One of the inmates who I know, because I developed correspondence with a number of them, was just released. And it's a terrible story. He was exonerated after serving 40 years. And so now he's actually got a job working in a small regional theater company, which I'm thrilled about for him. And he's working in the production side.
That's brilliant. See, theater saves lives.
Oh, I think for sure. And I wish that we could continue those programs. Now things are starting up again. And actually, it's interesting we're talking about this, because in Washington, D.C., we're about to do a big commitment with a women's prison using Beethoven's opera Fidelio, starting in a couple of months, where we will be bringing selections there and are working and going to be doing workshops and such with inmate groups.
Fabulous. West Side Story, of course, has one of the most magnificent scores for the musical theatre by Leonard Bernstein. He also wrote Candide in the same year. What a genius.
Oh, it's amazing, and I feel very lucky. I've directed Candide also a number of times. You know, Candide is a very different kind of story, obviously based on Voltaire's writings, and then lyrics and a lot of the book were by Comden and Green, and so it's much more erudite, sophisticated, cerebral, whereas West Side Story is much more visceral. But I think it's because a lot of the music of West Side Story is so much about dance and movement and physicality, whereas Candide, so much of it is about lyrics and these incredibly clever lyrics. Obviously great music on both sides and completely different kinds of music, which is, you know, Bernstein's unique genius. And again, represents also his conflict, whereas Candide is a much more classical piece. And West Side Story we think of as much more of a musical, even though I think the sophistication of rhythms and the textures and whatnot are certainly in line with, you know, music of, you know, Alban Berg.
Absolutely. He wrote four scores for the musical theatre, I believe. The other two were On the Town and Wonderful Town, both set in New York. He liked to use New York City as a canvas for his storytelling. Because it's so rich in culture and fabulous characters, which we've seen with all of them. The thing about your production, I think, on Handel Opera on the Harbour is that vast stage which floats on the harbour. It gives this wonderful sense of space of New York City. So we see the gangs actually chasing each other around that space.
With the set designer, Brian Thompson, it was important to me that we create city blocks. That was our idea. And so the stage is actually a huge city block, but has, let's say, much more abstract pieces in it. It has the house, which is Maria's tenement house. It has subway cars upended all over the place. It has a huge bridge. You know, again, Manhattan is an island, and so you can only get to it on a bridge or a tunnel. And that was important for us to have all those kinds of pieces of architecture. But also, in directing West Side Story, you have to deal with the huge scenes, the rumble, the quintet, the big dance numbers, the jet song, America, etc. But you also have a lot of very intimate scenes. And so we use the set so that, in a way, the subway cars move around to create different spaces and different streets. So that when you're playing an intimate scene, and I think it works successfully there, that even though you're in that huge audience, you do feel drawn in.
Need to create a close-up.
Yes, yeah. And so, you have to do that in an opera house as well, often. You know, you're going from an aria or a duet often to a big chorus scene. And I think that, Bernstein, you know, the piece goes back and forth very much between the music of the two gangs, you know, obviously. You know, the Sharks so influenced by, you know, salsa rhythms, and whereas the Jets, you know, it's a different language, it's much more jazz. And so for me, again, the spaces had to equal the music and have to equal the dance. And I wanted to work with the original choreography. So the choreographer here, Kira, who, you know, there's a group of people who basically specialize in doing Jerome Robbins' choreography, has been part of this team and has helped us recreate that choreography, because the music was written around the choreography. I mean, it was, Bernstein wrote it, but also it was rewritten, of course, or synthesized in the rehearsal process.
It was very much a holistic piece, all of those four creatives working together to create it.
I mean, Jamie Bernstein, the daughter of Leonard Bernstein, is a good friend of mine, and she's written a wonderful book about her relationship with her father. But just hearing some of the stories of this as a rehearsal process when she was a kid and watching it, you can imagine it. And, you know, when you talk about this piece, especially coming from New York, it's a universal piece, But it also feels very New York. And I do think that's the genius of it,
yeah.
is that it this story, you, it doesn't matter where you do it. I mean, I did West Side Story in Italy last year. You know, the Italians love this piece. You know, I have a friend who directed it in Tel Aviv and just changed it to, you know, it was, you know, the Jews and the Muslims. I mean, look, it's about conflict between groups, and that's what makes it a success.
Yeah. Is it tough staging an outdoor entertainment? I mean, you are exposed to the elements, whether that be a storm or a seagull.
Right. I love working outdoors. I do feel, you know, you can't compete with God. You have to accept the fact that there's a storm or wind or rain, although I'm always praying for no rain. But I do find it very inspirational because theater began outdoors. The Greeks, it began in the amphitheaters. And I do think it creates a special vibe with an audience, where an audience feels they're all part of this live event in a way different than when you're in a theater, which, you know, obviously in a theater you still have that connection of live, but it's like a sporting event. You know, most sporting events are outdoors. And the audience has a bonding around people pushing themselves to the extremes, and I think that is what happens in outdoors. I think performers, often it's very liberating for them, I find.
Opera Australia have, with Opera on the Harbour, staged a lot of operas, but of course 2019 we saw West Side Story, we also saw Phantom of the Opera recently. They've staged South Pacific indoors. We have seen a lot of musical theatre creeping into the opera season, but of course it's been happening overseas for a long time, and I know that at Glimmerglass you would frequently program musical theatre, traditional music theatre, into your opera seasons.
Right. I have always felt that musicals were, of course it's an American tradition, that they were our own version of opera. I think it's a lineage of so many of our composers, whether it was, you know, Hart, Hammerstein, Gershwin's, of course Sondheim, that they did come from a European tradition, and they understood classical music and opera, but they also understood, you know, Songspiel, Kurt Weill, opera comique, operetta, and that in a way it's a lineage with that, and then it fuses with American music, folk, gospel, jazz. And those, all of those different elements, I think, synthesize together to make American musicals, which I do think is very much it's part of our culture, part of our heritage, and our, I think, our own version of opera, although we've had a lot of great operas written in our country as well. And I think it's interesting how it's become an art form that has then given back to the world, how musicals have become so popular, you know, in the last two or three decades, really, on a global scale. I just think it's this really interesting export that we have created.
There are those hybrids, or sort of that sit on the fence, pieces like Porgy and Bess or Candide, which, are they musical theatre, are they opera? Sweeney Todd.
Right. I mean, Sondheim always said Sweeney Todd's not an opera, but it might be the musical most produced by opera houses, because it does have such a demanding vocal score, and opera singers love doing Sondheim's music. And opera singers, I think American opera singers, many of them come from two traditions, basically. They either went to school, high school, where they performed in musicals, or it's the church. The church is very strong in many cultures in the United States, and I think that either being in the choir in church or being in a musical in high school has almost always been the road to being an opera singer for American singers.
You staged Showboat at Glimmerglass. Of course, that was the first great musical theatre piece from last century. It's almost operetta in its start, isn't it?
Very much. I mean, certainly Rodgers and Hart in that case, written in 1927, we think of that as the first American musical. It uses jazz, operetta, opera. I mean, it has some very big ensembles. But it was really the beginning, in a way, of the art form, and also the fact that it was telling this unbelievably difficult story. You know, the story centers around the issue of miscegenation. of that it was illegal for a white person to marry a black person, and that that is really the genesis of the story. Of course, you follow this young girl, Magnolia, who grows up on the showboat and then leaves her, you know, becomes a performer. And the musical arches over something like 40 years. So it's an amazing, sprawling work. And I've loved doing that piece a few times. But it did lead, of course, to, you know, the 1930s, where we got, you know, the Gershwin brothers, obviously Porgy and Bess. 1936, Kurt Weill came to the United States right before World War II and began his American career with things like Street Scene, and then all of his American works, Knickerbocker Holiday, and then we get into the golden age of Rodgers and Hammerstein, starting writing right after the war and carrying right up through the early 60s, and of course there are many other composers in all these, but these were the sort of the giants who were writing in these times. And then you get to the 70s and you get Sondheim.
You were born in New York, yeah?
Yes.
Did Broadway figure much in your growing up years?
It figured some. My mother actually was a performer, and she did perform on Broadway. She was in On the Town when you mentioned it before.
Wow.
And so as a kid, I was around the theater a lot. My father was a businessman. He was Italian. And growing up, I spent a lot of time waiting for my mother backstage. Of course, now that would be completely illegal to have a kid be waiting backstage. But my brother and I often, you know, there was no babysitter, so we'd wait in my mother's dressing room. And then I really became interested much more in directing in long about high school, actually. But then I also started to get interested in opera about that time, because my family actually moved to Europe and we lived in Paris and then in Vienna. So I got exposed to a lot of different musical languages. So Broadway was part of my growing up, but it was, in a way, it sort of led over to opera more, because I think I liked the scale of opera, the complexity, and now I think in the last sort of two decades I've turned back some to musicals, because I think they're such an important part of the whole world of music theater, whatever you want to call this weird art form.
Those times waiting backstage for your mother, were you able to go into the wings and watch the show from the side with the stage manager?
I am sure that is why I am a director, is that I got to sit often with the stage manager. That's the person who's controlling the show from backstage, and watch scenery move, and, you know, just watching a show from the wings, from the side, is an incredible experience. And I think sometimes when you bring people backstage and have them watch, they just don't realize the complexity of what it takes to put on a show. And, you know, it is magic. Mm. It's transformative. So I definitely think being a kid backstage completely influenced my career choice.
I'm not a religious person, but I'm certainly spiritual when it comes to theatres. Theatres are our temples, I think, if you work in the industry. I mean, there's a smell about them as well. And once that gets to your blood, you can't get rid of it.
I absolutely agree. I always say that, you know, and when people complain at work, you know, when you're in rehearsal or something, I let people have it. I say, look how lucky we are. We're not in some boring job. We've got a thrilling job. And I do think post-COVID, people are much more appreciative and grateful for the world that we live in the world inside of a theater and a rehearsal hall, because it is a very special and sacred place.
Were you a bossy kid?
Somewhat. I used to write my own shows and puppet shows and put them on in the basement. Yeah.
So you were directing and producing at a young age.
Yeah. People who know me well might say that.
What was the first show or opera, indeed, that you saw that you think really started to seduce you also?
I think I saw Madama Butterfly probably in my mid-teens and was very taken by Puccini and the sweep and the scale. I had seen tons of musicals by then already. But I think that was really the first operatic experience my father brought me, and I remember it definitely made a big impression.
There's something about opera, isn't there? It's the big themes, the score. the great tragedy. I mean, it's very rare that an opera ends on a happy note.
Right. Right. We don't have enough comedies in opera. That's one of the great things about musicals. There's a lot more comedies.
So where did you train then or start to become a director? You worked your way up through stage management,
well,
I guess? Or
yeah. I mean, I definitely went through the school of what I would call apprenticeship. I started after university. I studied philosophy. Actually, didn't study theater. But I did theater all during those years and did summer stock, we call it, working backstage in different theaters. And after university, I moved to New York City and I got a job as a stage manager that's working basically backstage, helping put shows together. I wanted to be a director. I was very interested in that. I, you know, went to see, obviously, as much theater as I could, followed a lot of different directors, and then I ended up getting a couple of internships in Germany working for different directors in opera, which interested me. And then I ended up getting jobs back in the States, in particularly the San Francisco Opera. And when I was working there, I met a very famous director named Jean-Pierre Pinel, who was a French director. And he brought me to Europe, and I worked for him in Europe for much of my 20s in different theaters, you know, some of the great opera houses. And was very fortunate to do that.
The master's apprentice.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I do think that I went through, in a way, a kind of old-fashioned kind of guild training where I worked for him and several other directors, but who really were very important to me. And then, you know, it's like anything, you know, you're in the right place, right time, you get a break. My first sort of big Italian break was at La Fenice, and you know, I had been working there as an assistant, actually with him, and somebody canceled, and you get the show. And then I had the same thing happen in the United States at the Houston Grand Opera. Somebody canceled, they called me, I got a new production. And for a director, you know, it's really about creating not just the process of directing, but creating the whole visual world with designers. And so I was very fortunate to have some good breaks, which led to other things.
And then if you prove you're good, the other jobs will follow.
Right. And listen, you're not always good. I mean, I think that's one of the things that you have to learn about this career, that there are certain, you know, you can't always make it great. You have to learn how to fail and accept failure as well as success.
Well, from failure we learn, don't we?
Yes. And you also, there are certain theaters where it's just the right vibe, it's the right connection, and there are other theaters where it just doesn't work. I mean, I say that to people sometimes when they say, oh, well, I worked there and they didn't ask me back. And I said, you know, I'm like, and I have to remind myself this even now, you know, I've been doing this a long time. You have the right connection with a theater and the people and the audiences as well. I mean, that is who we're working for.
Were there many women directing at the time that you were getting your breaks?
No, I
felt. So was that tough to sort of break into that?
Absolutely. I encountered, I would say, a fair amount of discrimination along the way. I think now it's great. You see so many more women directors, obviously. When I started out, there were, I knew who a couple women were, but I did. It wasn't common. And also, it wasn't just directing. It's just theaters and opera houses weren't run by women. They were run by men.
So you need the women in those administration.
Yes, I think that's, that's one of the reasons now that I've had administrative positions now for 15 years. So I think I am pretty dedicated to making sure that I hire complete gender parity in all creative teams, conductors, directors, designers, etc., always.
Yeah. Your daily job, you were an administrator at Glimmerglass, which you stepped down from in 2022.
Yes.
Is that difficult balancing those two roles because you had an artistic role, but also...
Right. Well, no, I think, you know, I ran that company for 12 years, and I've also been the artistic director at the Kennedy Center in the opera company there for more than a decade. It's like producing. You are the producer, basically, in theater terms for opera. I think I really love doing it because, in a way, it's bigger than yourself. You know, when you're a director, it's really it's like your show, you're focused on just that. But when you are in this role of whether it's artistic director, general director, you're responsible for everything. And I love the sort of fact of, you know, putting together the whole thing and helping other people soar, because you become much more of a we than an I. And that's how when people take over companies, I say you really have to be prepared to accept the fact that it's not about you anymore. It's about a much bigger thing. And so I find creating that bigger thing, making that bigger thing work is super satisfying.
At Glimmerglass, I think you were working in a theater that seated about 900?
Yeah, it's under 1,000.
And the Kennedy Center, the opera theater there, is close to 3?
Well, actually, we're very lucky at the Kennedy Center. We have 3 theaters. Right. And so I produce opera in the Opera House, which is 2,200, and then a middle-sized theater called the Eisenhower after the President, that's 1,000, and then a small theater, the Terrace, which is 500. So I get to produce on a big palette of different sizes. But, I mean, I've worked at, you know, the Met, that's 3,800, La Scala, the Bastille, those are all huge theaters. And as a director, it's so much about scale, you know, how you work in the huge proscenium theater like that, or an outdoor theater like this, or, I don't know, I've worked in, you know, the Arena in Orange or Verona. You know, you have to be able to deal with the scale and also how to deal with creating intimacy. And the same thing, when you work on an intimate space, you have to be able to often create scale because you might be dealing with very big ideas. So, you know, ideas, the subject matter has to parallel how you use the space.
Do you have a favorite opera house?
No, I don't want to say that.
Would it be like saying, do you have a favorite child?
Yeah, that'd be terrible.
Yeah,
that'd
yeah.
Be, of course, I love coming to Australia. It's a beautiful,
of course,
beautiful working
of course.
Here.
But as I said a few minutes ago, you know, the theaters are our temples, aren't they? And
yes.
Sort of how can you choose one church over another?
No, you can't.
So, look, you're very kind. You're doing this interview in a break between rehearsals. But how do you like to unwind when you finish rehearsal?
Well, I like to read a lot at night, but I find I unwind more actually first thing in the morning, particularly here in Australia. I love this climate and this city. I love Sydney. I love doing things outdoors. I love getting up this morning. I was up super early, and I went to Wiley's Baths in Coogee, which is one of my favorite places to go in the city. I love walking along the cliffs here, like by Bronte and by Bondi. I love nature, so wherever I work, I love to find a place to be able to get out in nature. That's kind of, for me, the thing that helps me do my job.
For a lot of directors, it's about letting go on opening night and handing it over to the company to look after. Are you good at that?
No, I'm terrible, terrible, terrible. My entire being suffers with them. You know, you feel every breath, every little misstep, whatever. So, of course, I know I have to give it over to the company, and often for opera, you're giving it over to the conductor as well. But you suffer, and then you go away. And that's why it's so great to come back and see a show that's been running for a while, because you enjoy it so much more.
Well, hopefully you might get a chance to come back in 2 or 3 weeks, maybe, and have a look at West Side Story once it's running. You're very busy. What are you going back to?
I'm going back to Houston, Texas, to direct The Sound of Music.
Wonderful.
Which I'm thrilled about. And then that will be starring Isabel Leonard, who's a very famous opera singer. And then I will be going to my home theater, the Kennedy Center, to do a new production of Turandot, which I'm very excited about. We are doing a new ending. I've commissioned a composer named Christopher Tin, who is a very well-known gaming composer. He's written the music for things like Civilization 4 and things like that. He's a classically trained composer. And the librettist is a woman, Susan Stanton, who is the writer of the TV show Succession, I don't know if Succession was very popular
here. Huge
hit
here. One of our Australian actresses, Sarah Snook, was playing one of the roles.
Well, she was phenomenal.
Yeah.
Anyway, the new ending really takes, because of course, for those who don't know, Puccini died before he completed the opera. And so we've been performing for the last 100 years an ending that one of his students wrote, but I've always found it very unsatisfying because the character Turandot suddenly changes from being this strong female leader to getting all weak-kneed because the love interest, Khalaf, kisses her and she says, okay, you can run the kingdom now. And so this new ending creates a much more powerful ending that I think is leaves her as a strong woman and creates a kind of democracy. So I'm thrilled to be working on those projects in the next couple of months.
That's fascinating because there are not only opera, there's a lot of musical theatre pieces which could do with revisiting and retinkering for a contemporary audience because they might be seen to be problematic.
Absolutely. And I think that right now we're in many cases addressing a lot of these works and figuring out how we do them.
Yeah, whether that be, one that's often mentioned is Carousel.
Right. Well, of course, the central issue in Carousel is that
the domestic
Billy,
violence, yeah.
Billy, you know, hits his wife-to-be and then, of course, has to visit, see his daughter from heaven. I mean, I find Carousel very difficult. I can't do it. I was asked to do it twice and I've never done it because I don't...
Don't know how
I
to solve
just
it.
Don't know how to... I don't know how to justify that.
Well, you certainly have justified the romance of Tony and Maria in West Side Story. It's playing at the Fleet Steps, which is a beautiful, isn't it, a beautiful location in Sydney?
I love walking there. I love approaching it and seeing the harbour. And when you're sitting in the audience, you're looking at the set, but behind the set, you're looking at the magnificent bridge and the opera house.
Yeah, who could ask for anything more? Francesca Zambello, thank you so much for this conversation.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
The musical masterpiece West Side Story exploded onto Broadway in 1957 in a sensational storm of exuberant dance and wistful romance. It is a phenomenon that has never faded. In 2024, the iconic musical returns to Hand Opera on Sydney Harbour in an electrifying larger-than-life staging. Experience the greatest score ever written for musical theatre, dynamic dance numbers that soar through the open air, and a love story for the ages. Leonard Bernstein's score is punctuated with hits America, Tonight, Maria, I Feel Pretty, and the enduring Somewhere. Opera and musical theatre great Francesca Zambello directs a production that revels in all that's beautiful about West Side Story, with designers Brian Thompson and Jennifer Irwin transforming Sydney into a slice of New York. Musical director is Guy Simpson. See why this staging became the highest selling ever on the harbour top stage, delighting audiences and critics. If you've never been to Handa Opera on Sydney Harbour, prepare for a remarkable night out. West Side Story plays March 22 to April 21. Access your tickets via the OA website. I'm Peter Ayers. Keep well, keep warm, stay safe, and I'll catch you next time on Stages.